Bud Burton Moss has spent over 50 years working as a top talent agent in Hollywood, representing such stars as Rita Hayworth, Betty Davis, Sid Cherie, Sidney Poitier, Robert Vaughn, and Tom Bosley. In a new book called Hollywood, Sometimes the Reality is Better Than the Dream, Mr. Moss gives a first-person account of the golden years of Hollywood and goes behind the scenes, revealing some of the backroom secrets of the movie world. It's published by Waterfront Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bud Burton Moss to our show today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Larry King wrote in the foreword to your book that you were born at Hollywood Children's Hospital in the shadow of Hollywood Boulevard and never left. Do you think that you were destined for a career in show business?
At that time, I think I was. My father was a film editor at Fox. My uncle was Sam Zimbalist, probably one of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's greatest producers, who did Ben-Hur and Quo Vadis. So I grew up within the industry.
Didn't he die during the filming of Ben-Hur?
Very, very true. Sam had been trying to get another $5 million to complete the film. Today it would have been $50 million. And this was the day after the chariot race. And he was so emotionally wound up. And he had been trying to get that kind of money from George Skank and the people at Metro. He had a stroke right on the set and died.
As a boy, you write, you swam in your uncle's pool with Katharine Hepburn and Clark Gable on Sunday afternoons. That's pretty impressive. Was your father also in the business?
He was a film editor at Fox, and he happened to be one of the film editors on Blood and Sand. And when I was 11 years old, my dad took me to a cast and crew screening, and sitting on my right was Tony Quinn, Linda Darnell. Ty Power couldn't get there that day.
He played the matador.
That he did. And the minute that Rita came on the screen,
Rita Hayworth,
I leaned over to my mother and I whispered to her, "Mom, she's almost as beautiful as you with the same flaming red hair." And from that moment on, I knew that my life was going to be destined to find and meet Rita Hayworth.
Which you later did. But as a teenager, you worked as a busboy at Fox Studios Commissary in private dining rooms. Was that good entree into the film world?
Well, it couldn't have been any better for me, because one day I'm bussing the dishes, and all of a sudden, 6 years later from the time that I saw Rita in Blood and Sand, in she walked with Daryl F. Zanuck. And I froze, Leonard. I sat there, and I said, "Good God, there she is. This is the time that I've waited my life to meet her. Do you think it's time for me to propose to her?" I mean, I'm trying to conjure up. I said, "I hope she's going to wait until I'm at least 21 so I could ask her to marry her." Just at that point, I get hit in the head by a wet towel, and it's the maitre d' who said, "Bud, get over there and clean off table 12.
Pay attention to your job."
Exactly.
But you also got to meet Tyrone Power.
I met Ty.
And Betty Grable, Marilyn Monroe, Henry Fonda, Cesar Romero. Rita Hayworth was the most important of that batch for you?
Well, for me it was. I mean, I grew up watching all the films. My dad, my mom, we were all film buffs. But whenever there was a Rita Hayworth film, we were there.
He also worked at the 76 gas station across the street from MGM Studios. So you wound up in the cars of some of the most important
people. I was getting closer
people.
And closer to stardom, Leonard, because what happened is I got a Guild card through a producer-director friend of my uncle's. I didn't want to go to my uncle and ask him for a card, a SAG card. So Norman Torog, one of Hollywood's great directors, had me pick his daughter up from Emerson High School every other week, and I asked him, I said, "Please, can you help me? I don't want to ask my uncle. Get me a Guild card," which he took care of. That eventually got me on the lot, and I was able to work in maybe 10, 15 movies over the years at Metro, along with other places.
But working in what capacities?
As an extra, mm-hmm. Doing bit work.
You say that that you either wanted to be an actor after you saw Blood and Sand, or a bullfighter. Bullfighting does not have the same kind of status today as it did in those days.
That is correct. And for a little Jewish boy from Culver City, I decided when I got to be in my early 20s, my folks had a restaurant in West Los Angeles called the Matador, and it was a shrine to bullfighting. And every actor who would go to the bullfights on Sunday afternoons would stop at my bar, my restaurant, or afterwards to see who was coming there that was famous. And people like Luis Miguel Dominguín, who was the bullfighter that stole Ava Gardner from away, Carlos Arruza, the great Mexican bullfighter, everybody would come to that place as kind of to pay tribute to the world of bullfighting.
But you wanted to be an actor. You took acting lessons.
I took acting lessons. I did a lot of bit work. I did a lot of little theater work around town up in San Francisco. So I finally, when I decided to move ahead with my career, one Sunday afternoon at the bullfights in Tijuana, I walked into the Caesar Hotel, and there was Tony Quinn. And he waved over to me. He says, "Bud, come over here." I mean, we were close friends with my dad. And as I sat down, he introduced me to a young actress by the name of Ruth Roman. Hmm. Bud, Ruth Roman. And as you saw in the foreword, we started talking about careers. I listed all of her movies from Strangers on a Train to Blowing Wild with Cooper. And we started to date. And lo and behold, within that year, we decided to get married. Where are we going to go for our honeymoon? We flipped a coin and said, "Let's go to Spain." And we went over there for 3 months.
Back to the bullfights.
And we followed Dominguín for 2 years. We lived in Spain.
My guest is Bud Burton Moss. He has written a book that is called Hollywood: Sometimes the Reality is Better Than the Dream. It is available from Waterfront Press. This is WMIC.
And also
WMIC.
Amazon.
Also your son?
No, I said on Amazon, the book's available.
This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What films did you appear in as an extra?
I was in that marvelous dance scene with Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed in a movie called It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, wow. So when that film, which is probably shown on television more than anything else every Christmas, I think partly because they don't have to pay royalties for it.
Right.
Do you spot yourself when you're watching it?
In that movie, I couldn't. I mean, there was when the pool started to open and they started to fall in, and then everybody said, "Gee, that's a great thing." We all started to jump in. I mean, I thought I knew where I was, but I never saw it. But there was a film called Bridges of Tokaray with Bill Holden and Grace Kelly. And I was Mickey Rooney's assistant, medical assistant on the aircraft carrier. And I had a big cross on my chest, a red cross sign, and I knew I could spot myself in that film.
You enlisted in the Air Force during the Korean War. How did you end up producing plays to entertain the troops on base rather than going
over to
into
Korea.
Combat?
Yeah, over to Korea. I was what they call permanent party when this new base first opened up, Parks Air Force Base. And one day, probably 3 months into my training, I get a call from the sergeant saying, "General Parks says it's urgent that you come up to his office and meet with him." Now, here I am, a PFC, and a three-star general wanted to see me. So I shaved, showered, and put on my gabardine outfit. And when I finally got there, the lieutenant said, "Why are you late?" And I said, "Well, I had to get dressed." He says, "You should have just gotten into your fatigues. The general's gone to lunch, and you'll have to wait for him." Half hour later, the general comes in. I salute him. He says, "Sit down, Aaron Moss." And I'm sitting there, and all that was on his desk, Leonard, was a little white envelope. And on the side, it said, M-O-S-S. And I looked at it, and he opened it up, and he said, "Airman Moss, what are you going to do when you get out of the service?" I said, "I'll probably go back into the motion picture industry." He said, "I see you have a very famous uncle who made a film called 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, which was always my favorite film." He said, "I have a problem, and I'd like to discuss it with you. Now, here's this three-star general." And he said, "Well, what is it, General? What can I do to help you?" He said, "I have a son who wants to be an actor." All of a sudden, I can see sergeant stripes on my shoulder. I can see lieutenant stripes. And I said, "Well, you know, General, I happen to be working with Mills College, a girls' school in Oakland. And I'm directing a production of The Importance of Being of Earnest. And I said, we're going to do Ring Round the Moon." And I listed a thing. "Your son is going to become my stage manager, my personal stage manager." Leonard, I had trucks, I had buses, I had limousines available to me for 2 years while I was there. And we actually took maybe 15 or 20 young servicemen who never thought of being actors, and I would put them into these plays.
Was it during that time that you also met Barbara Eden, who was a USO entertainer?
She had another name, but she came out to this dance, and she, years later, I confronted with her. She says, well, he was from Oakland, and chances are, because I did many of these different USO dances, she says, we probably did meet. And it was at that time we put a deal together for her and Larry Hagman to do I Dream of Jeannie.
Then did you marry Ruth Roman after you got out of the military?
I married Ruth in 1956 after the service, and we went to Spain. We were there for 2 years. And when we came back, Ruth got a call from Martin Baum, who was a very well-known Broadway agent, who said, Anne Bancroft is looking for a replacement to play Two for the Seesaw that she did with Fonda and then take the play out of the National Company. And Marty Baum said, what are you going to do at the time? And I said, well, I might go back to acting or directing. He said, I think you could be a good agent. So he brought me in to General Artists Corporation in 1960. And he said, when I come to Hollywood, I've got 10 actors that I promise you one day, Bud, these unknown actors will be stars. And of those 10 known actors, there was Carol O'Connor, Martin Landau, Michael Tolan, Ina Balin, Cliff Robertson, Elizabeth Montgomery, and a young actor by the name of Sidney Poitier.
You also, that agency also represented Rita Hayworth, your
dream. No, Rita was not a client of that agency.
What about Sid Charisse?
Sid was a client.
Robert Vaughn?
Robert Vaughn, I put into Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Carl Malden?
Carl came with me towards the latter part of his career, but I did represent him.
And June Allison?
June Allison, I first met when I was doing extra work, and then years later I was her agent.
Now, Ruth Roman got some wonderful roles, and you mentioned she was in Strangers on a Train, which is one of the greatest of the Hitchcock films.
Right.
But how come she didn't become a bigger star?
That's the question that is always asked the agent, what happened after the great movies? And these were follow-ups. I mean, we weren't representing her until when we got married in the 60s, and her career at that point started to diminish. But just before we left Spain, Ruth got a call from Nicholas Ray, whom we all know as one of our great directors, and said, Ruth, I'm in the south of France. I'm on my way to Nice to meet a young actor by the name of Richard Burton, and we're going to do a film, and we just lost our leading lady who went into some other project, and we'd like to have you play the love interest opposite Richard Burton. Leonard, I spent 4 weeks at the Negresco Hotel with Richard, his wife, Ruth, and her son.
This is before Elizabeth Taylor.
This is long before. But I must tell you, I saw this young, aggressive, dynamic young actor literally take over every scene in that film. And every time we went someplace, like to a club, all the women, wherever we were, started to focus in on him. And it was quite a treat.
What happened to your marriage?
What happened to the marriage? The business was such that all of a sudden, over the first 3 or 4 years, my career started to zoom. I was the new hotshot agent in Hollywood. I put Liz Montgomery into Bewitched. I put Robert Vaughn into Man from U.N.C.L.E. I did all. And we had put Ruth into a series called, with Eddie O'Brien, I want to say Summertime something, I can't remember. But it lasted 2 years. And her career at that point, so when I used to come home and I'd say, gee, Ruth, today I took Mia Farrow over to Paramount and we had this meeting and all that, and I listed all the things that I was doing. And she said, great. What about me? What did you do for me today? And it was just a matter of a marriage being broken up because we were both consumed by the industry.
And you're moving in different directions.
Exactly. Speaking of Sid Charisse, I have to tell you one of my favorite moments on Broadway. Jimmy Nedelanier Sr., God bless him, was always one of Sid Charisse's greatest fans. And for years he said, I'm going to get you to Broadway. Sid Charisse never appeared on Broadway. And when Tommy Toon's production of Grand Hotel opened up, Lillian Montevecchi, is that how you pronounce her name?
I guess so.
Played the fading ballet dancer in Grand Hotel. And Jimmy said from that time, he says, as soon as it's possible, I'm going to get you in to play that part on Broadway. And a year or two passed, and as successful as the show was, we could never get back there.
I consider you a great success because thinking of some of the people you represented, they were on our show. We've had Sid Charisse, who came here with Tony Martin.
Boy, that's a long time ago.
Well, I've been doing the show for a while. Robert Vaughn, Carl Malden, Barbara Eden.
Sitting in the lobby, who said to say hello to you, is Greg Mulavey, who came over to see me, who's an ex-client of mine.
Well, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I'm going to find out how you came to represent Rita Hayworth and talk about some of those stories, many of them quite sad, unfortunately. I'm speaking with Bud Burton Moss. His book, Hollywood, Sometimes the Reality is Better Than the Dream. And we are back with Bud Burton Moss. His book, Hollywood, Sometimes the Reality is Better Than the Dream. It's published by Waterfront Press. This whole thing started with Rita Hayworth, and you finally came to represent her. How did that happen?
Well, it was in 1960 that, 1967, very few people in those days knew the word Alzheimer's. It was a word that nobody found in the dictionary.
But she was still very young. Didn't she have very early onset Alzheimer's?
Rita and I spent her 50th birthday in this film that I took her over to Spain called The Bastards. And it was at that time that we went to Toledo, Spain on her 50th birthday. And there were some signs beginning then where she would have these little tantrums, thinking that she might have been somebody else, or you might have been somebody else.
Weren't the rumors that she was an alcoholic?
Well, that was the first thing that Eddie Feldman said to me. He was the producer of Warner Brothers, and he said, we heard that she's a drinker, that she's a fighter, she's this or that. And the doctors, years later, finally admitted that after all the treatment they had trying to find out why she was an alcoholic, she still had these fits.
You detail your trip to London with Rita in 1976. That's 8 years.
That was probably the worst trip that we took, because the minute that we took off on the plane and we were having dinner upstairs, she jumped up and started yelling at me, thinking I was Gary Cooper, and talking about all the sluts that he's been sleeping with. And she said, I'm always sitting off in the corner waiting for you to come home.
So she thought you were Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
Well, she really must have been delusional. I'm sorry, you're a good-looking man, but you don't look like Gary Cooper.
No, I really don't.
So then what happened? That's right before the flight landed in Heathrow. Did the paparazzi were there. What happened?
Well, what happened
as a result?
Is when the plane was coming in for a landing, the flight attendant was carrying the coats around for all the people, and they held up Rita's brand-new $20,000 mink coat. And the minute that this stewardess held this coat up for Rita, she said, you slut, where are you going? And she slapped her in the face. You're stealing my fur coat. And I grabbed the stewardess. We grabbed the fur coat. And all of a sudden, the stewardess ran up top to the pilot and apparently reported that something had happened on the plane. So by the time we landed in London, the captain said, there's 30 in press in the lobby waiting to see her. And I said, I'm going to go out and talk to her. I said, I don't want anybody to see Rita the way that she was. So they took everybody off the plane. And finally, the captain says, I brought around one of those portable staircases, and we're going to lower Rita down into the limousine and get her to the hotel. Her legs were like rubber, Leonard. And as we were going down the stairs, just to the bottom stair, one of the paparazzis had hijacked a golf cart. And he came over, and if you'll remember in that book, there's the most horrific photo of Rita that went around the world in 60 seconds.
And she was still in her 50s at this point.
I was with her for her 50th birthday when that took place.
Now, you also went with her down to Buenos Aires. Weren't you wary of taking trips with her?
We were wary, but there had been a window between January of 76 and October of 76, and everybody seemed to felt that she was ready for another trip. We didn't know at that time there was a dirty war going on in Argentina. Isabel Perón had been dethroned. There was a three-man junta that was running the government. And we literally got off the plane and we were surrounded with security with machine guns. And they said...
I don't think it was Eva Perón. It was the...
Isabel.
Isabel, yeah.
Did I say Eva?
Maybe you said Isabel.
It is, yeah.
The woman he met in Spain and brought back with him, who took over after he died, after Juan Perón died.
Right. And she was dethroned at that point. But from the minute we got off and we got into Buenos Aires to the hotel, Rita went to the window to say, gee, what a beautiful view. And a bomb exploded right at the base of our hotel, knocking us all to the floor. The security was all over us. And everywhere we went for the 3 days that we were there, including the American embassy, when we left the embassy, another bomb went off. So we were on our way to go to Rio de Janeiro to be with Rita's ex-lover from many years before by the name of Jorge Ginley, who owned the Copacabana Hotel. You know the word Lothario?
He was an example.
He was the epitome with Ali Khan, with Ruber Osso. Today's Lotharios are Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson. You know, all their life is they just wanted to spend money and have as many women as they could at that point. So he had this dinner party for us in Rio de Janeiro, and we stayed with him at the hotel for 3 days. And when we were supposed to go up to Sugarloaf, Rita decided not to go at the last moment, and we thought that she was going to be taken care of by security. And when we came back to the hotel, she had disappeared. Now, we spent the whole afternoon with hotel security. They wanted to call the police, and I said, don't, because if it hit the newspapers, then everybody would be in trouble. We spent 3 hours walking on the beach with security, thinking, God, what could have happened for Rita? And finally, we get to the end of the beach near Ipanema, and we saw one of the lifeguards there, and he said, there's a big crowd of kids down the road. Maybe that's where she is. And all of a sudden, we go down there, Leonard, and there's all these kids with these kites. You know how they love to fly the kites? And Rita was right in the middle of all of them holding the kite. And had I had a camera, it would have been probably the most beautiful picture
of
her.
Now you just pull out your phone.
Yeah.
But how long before she died?
She died in 87. Princess Yasmin said to me, I'm going to have Mom retire. This is 1980. And by that time, she started going to every doctor in the world to start finding out. And slowly, she started to decay and disintegrate. And Yasmin kept her in this apartment, which was kind of like a hospital. And in 1987, I got a phone call. And she's, Mom just passed away, and we're coming to Hollywood, and I want you to be one of the pallbearers.
Meanwhile, you were representing some of Hollywood's most bankable clients or creating them. You suggested Mia Farrow for Peyton Place. But didn't you also set her up with Frank Sinatra?
I took her over to meet Paul Monash, who put her in the series. He loved her. When she started working the show, I gave her a stack of my business cards. I said, Mia, you're going to be a big star, and you're going to get hit on by more people for more different things than you can imagine. And finally, one morning, my secretary said, Bud, Frank Sinatra's on the phone. I said, sure, and Marilyn Monroe's out in the lobby waiting for me. He said, no, it really sounded like him. So I picked up the phone. I said, Bud Moss? He says, yes, this is Frank Sinatra. And I said, what can I do for you, Frank? And he says, well, I was at a dinner party recently, and I met this young girl. The people that hosted this dinner said she's a famous star on Peyton Place. And I said, I'd like to be your friend. I'd like to help you. Maybe I can coach you and be your mentor. And I'd love to take you to dinner next week. And she said, Mr. Sinatra, I'd be honored. But just wait a second. And she ran over to get her purse. And she started looking through her purse, and her lipstick fell on the floor, her makeup case. And she finally found this business card. And she said, Bud Moss said that no matter who it is, Mr. Sinatra, tell him that it's okay, but he wants you to call him. And that's how he called. So when I called her back, she said, oh, God, did he really call me? And I said, yes. And that started that two-year relationship.
And then we had her on our show. She talked about why that relationship broke up, but I'm not going to go into it. It's too complicated. Yeah. People might check out our archives. She was on our show a number of times. You started your own agency in around this time, 67. Was being a manager different from working as an agent?
I had been an agent with General Artists Corporation, with Marty Baum and Poitier and those actors, and I got in a big argument with my boss in a staff meeting about Nancy Sinatra, who I had just put into a television show called Man from U.N.C.L.E. And the studio wanted to test her for a new series they were going to do on Sunday in New York. And my boss in a staff meeting with 15 guys said, who do they want to test? And I said, Nancy Sinatra. He said, Bud, what is her last name? I said, Sinatra. He said, repeat.
She got the job.
Very carefully now. Say her name, Nancy Sinatra. And he said, Bud, Sinatras don't test. Tell them to send me a contract. I said, Marty, she just did one Man from U.N.C.L.E. And it got into a heated argument. And I said, she's going to test. I'm the head of the television department. And he says, I'm the head of the studio here. If she tests, you're fired. I said, if she doesn't test, I'm quitting. And that's where we drew the line in the sand, and I quit. I was dating Carolyn Jones at the time. And I called her, and I said, I've just quit GAC. And she says, come on home. Let's open a bottle of champagne, and we'll talk about your future.
She had been married to Aaron Spelling, who was an actor at the time.
He was,
and that complicated
he was an extra. We both were extras at one time.
A lot of this stuff sounds like the kinds of things that we heard about Hollywood in the gossip columns at the time, and I can't go into all of them. But you married a different woman, Carolyn Gehry. Was it Jerry?
Carolyn Gehry was a Beverly Hills Jewish princess that knew nothing about the business and really didn't want to know anything.
So that was made her more attractive.
That's right. 45 years later, she's still my wife, and we're very, very happy.
And Sidney Poitier was your best man.
Sidney was my best man. We got married at Melvin Belli's home, whom I'm sure you knew or knew the name.
Mm-hmm. In what ways have Hollywood talent agencies and the business changed over the years?
How do you spell the word computer?
That's really the big thing?
During the 60s and 70s, agents could walk on any lot at studios. Kenny Hollywood was the cop at MGM Studios. And as long as Kenny would get a bottle of scotch at Christmas time every year, any agent who had any kind of clout, who represented any people of any importance, you could walk on the studio. You could walk the halls, and if a producer didn't have anybody in his office, you knew that the secretary was going to get a bottle of perfume. So she'd say, Bud Moss is here, and he would want to talk to you. Today, you can't do that any longer.
What about TV? Because as time went on, you were placing as many clients on television shows as you were in movies. Tom Bosley was in Happy Days, Henry Winkler. You did Sally Kellerman on MASH, Elizabeth Montgomery on Bewitched. You, on the other hand, you placed Diane Cannon on Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice. You're still in the business, aren't you? Where's the bulk of your work these days?
Winding back just a little, I did Larry King's show before the holidays. And he said, why are you working so hard, Bud? What have you done? I said, I got three actresses, Oscar nominations. Sally Kellerman was part of my agency, and I asked her to go and meet Bob Altman, who was directing a film called MASH. Mm-hmm. She said, my manager read the script and hated it, and he didn't think that I should do it. I left the agency, I called her, and I said, you get over to Fox right away and meet Bob Altman. She got the picture, got an Oscar nomination. A year later, I get a call from Bill Self, the head of Fox Studios, and said, Bud, we are going to make a pilot called MASH with Robert Alda. We want Sally to recreate her part. I get a call from her manager saying, we're getting a new agent. How dare you even think that Sally would now want to do the series that she made the movie famous for? Besides, it's not going to last. Loretta Swift, I believe, ended up playing that part of Hot Lips $5 or $10 million later, and Sally's singing one-nighters in Hollywood these days. Same thing with Diane Cannon.
Now, you mentioned computers. That's because copyright laws now can all be thrown out the window, in effect?
My dear beloved friend Jack Valenti spent a lot of time trying to secure the rights for writers, producers, directors, and it all went out the window.
He was the president of the Motion Picture Association of America for 38 years.
39, to be exact. And then Jack and I became partners on a movie based upon a book that he wrote called Protect and Defend. And we spent over 10 years between Peter Bogdanovich and my dear Laura Pels, who I'm going to see this afternoon, Dina and Ted Hartley, Dina Merrill, and last, Lorenzo de Bonaventura. And all of these pictures, the deals crashed because we couldn't find a right script.
Now, you're going to be giving a talk and signing books this Thursday, the 10th, at 11 a.m., when you open the Long Island International Gold Coast Film Festival at the Amsterdam Hotel in Port Washington, Long Island. We have details for that on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. But you also came to New York for another event?
Through my dear friend Kathy Soroff, who arranged. I was delighted to speak Sunday. I flew in Saturday night to speak Sunday at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And there's a very talented young man who will go to Hollywood one of these days who produced the show by the name of Raj Towney. And between him and Regina Gill, who heads up the Gold Coast Film Festival, and a show called Leonard Lopate, that's why I'm here today.
Leonard Lopate, okay. Well, anyway, the person I've been speaking with is Bud Burton Moss. His book, Hollywood, Sometimes the Reality is Better Than the Dream, it is published by Waterfront Press.
And Amazon.
And Amazon. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
I'm thrilled. I really appreciate it. Thank you.